This morning, we have a very special guest with us. He's our middle school pastor. His name is Fred. He loves kids, but he also loves the Bible and he loves Jesus. So Christ the King, let's put our hands together for newlywed, as well as middle school pastor, as well as a man who loves Jesus very, very deeply. Let's welcome together Pastor Fred Hartsook.
Good morning, church. All right, some of you had coffee. You know it's free. You know the cup. Just kidding. My name is Pastor Fred Hartsook. As Grant mentioned, I am newlywed. I was married 3 weeks ago. This is where you cheer for me. Yes. And I've been on staff almost 2 years, working with our awesome middle schoolers. So that means I don't know what all of you do for work, but I have to tell you, what I know about being a middle school pastor is that my job is way better than yours. Okay? Where in the world, much less the church, do you get paid to shoot Nerf guns and throw dodgeballs and eat cheeseburgers and pizza? I mean, there's no job like it. Besides that, though, I want to brag on my kids a little bit. This last Friday, we went down to Marine Park. It was a sunny tropical evening, if you guys remember. And I got to baptize 5 middle schoolers in the water on Friday night. So you need to cheer for them. Those guys are just incredible, incredible. So I love my work here, and this is my first time actually sharing in this way from this stage in this setting. You might have seen me up here before doing ridiculous things, if you were here for Easter and things like that. So here's what I need to make a deal with you guys, okay? So because this is my first time doing this, and this is your first time hearing me share in this way, I want to make a deal with you. So here's what I need from you, is that if I get slipped up on my notes, or if I have to like go back, or if I make a mistake here or there, would you just give me a little bit extra grace this morning? Would that be okay? Would you guys do that for me? All right, here's what I'll do for you in return. Because like I said, I'm used to speaking with middle schoolers. I speak with them every week almost. I will bring the content down to a level you adults can understand, okay? I will reformulate it so that adults can grasp it, okay? Is that a good deal? And if you think I'm kidding, you should have a spiritual conversation with a teenager. These guys will blow your mind, I promise you. So let's get started. Today, we explore a blank in God is blank that it seems like nobody really likes to acknowledge. Okay, we're getting into something here that doesn't feel really good to talk about. And it doesn't really matter what your relationship is with God when it comes to this. I don't think anybody likes talking about this one. But we have to pay attention, I believe, because it's a word that God actually uses to describe himself. There are several key moments all throughout the Bible where God is describing himself with this word. And so it must be important, and we can't just brush it aside. Today's word is God is jealous. God is jealous. Does that make anyone feel icky? I don't know. Icky, is that a thing? Jealous is not a word that we want to associate with God, right? It's just not something that we like to hear about, or not something that we like to think of God as being. Some of us are probably in this room thinking, well, Fred, I've read Paul's letters in the New Testament. Paul names jealousy as a sin that will lead the church away from God. What about that? That's a good question. Probably a lot of us in this room, probably all of us, have had a relationship with somebody that we cared about damaged because jealousy entered the relationship and drove a wedge and caused this pain. That's probably true of most of us. Maybe some of you are like me, and you've actually named jealousy in a prayer to God of saying, God, will you take this from me? This is a sin that's causing damage in my relationships, and most importantly, in my relationship with you, God. Would you take that from me? Those are important and real things. Those feelings that you've had about jealousy, they're real. I want to affirm that in you, okay? But I want us to think, maybe consider for just a minute that's not the same definition that God is working with when he describes himself as jealous. That maybe we have a different cultural and human understanding of what that is, and he has something different, okay? I think that if we are able to find and tap in even a little bit to what God means when he says he is jealous, that we'll find out that it's actually one of his best traits. And it's actually really, really good news for all of us. So let's do this. As Grant said, I like the Bible. Everyone, you know, you've heard of the Bible. Okay. When we want to talk about something about a particular word that God uses or that is in the Bible, first thing we want to do is look for the first place that it's used. So the first place that God being jealous is referenced in the Bible is in Exodus chapter 20. So So if you have your Bibles, you can open that to Exodus chapter 20. What's happening in the story right here is that God is addressing his people through his prophet Moses. He's called Moses out, set him aside as a prophet, and now he's addressing his people. God has just freed Moses and his people from slavery and has delivered them, and they're free, but now they're kind of in this holding pattern of like, God, what do you want with us now? What does our relationship look like now? What do you need from us? And so God has to establish this new covenant with them for relationship. And covenant, if you don't know, is just sort of a fancy, highfalutin kind of word that means contractual agreement. Okay, so God and his people need to establish a new contractual agreement for their relationship. So God pulls him out, and he gives him a new covenant. And he writes this whole thing, and it begins with what we now call the Ten Commandments. Heard of those? I thought so. Okay, three of you. Good. God did not actually call them the Ten Commandments. We call them that. But what's interesting is this whole covenant is just filled with hundreds of laws and procedures and traditions, and they're all really conditional, and there's certain really specific things. But these Ten Commandments, they aren't written like the rest of the laws. They're written like promises. They're written like, okay, if we're going to start this covenant relationship together, we're going to agree to these promises. And I think that's really cool. So here's what it says. God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not make for yourself an image or likeness, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. God, in creating this new covenant for relationship with his people, makes the first two components of that relationship, I think, really, really clear for us. Okay, first of all, you shall have no other gods before me. That is one translation. Another translation is, you shall have no other gods instead of me. Another translation, and probably the most accurate, is you shall have no other gods in my presence. So at this time, it was commonly understood among people that there were many, many gods. There was divine assemblies. There was a pantheon. You had to appeal to all these various gods and earn favor if you wanted to live. So there was a god of rain. That was kind of a big one because this is you're living and dying by the fields. God of sun, god of the sea, god of harvest, god of the trees. There was gods for everything, and you had to please all of them. And God is saying, I'm the only one. You don't bring any of those other gods around here. If you want to have a relationship with me, you have to give up all your other gods. This was a huge demand that God was asking for. If you believe that your life literally depended on pleasing tons of gods, and suddenly this God said, if you want to follow me, if you want to have a relationship with me, you only have me, that would be pretty difficult for us, right? Because they didn't have Costco then. They didn't have Trader Joe's then. They didn't have Macy's. They didn't have a brand new H&M. They didn't have that. They had to depend on these gods, or so they thought, right? So this is a huge demand. This is no small thing. The second thing that God says is you shall not make of yourself an image or likeness, which means you shall not make for yourself any idols. And we often think now probably idols are things that create that represent beings that are opposed to God, and God is surely naming that. But what was also happening in this time was the people who were following God actually made idols of God himself. And what would happen then is they would worship and serve those idols, trying to invoke God to do their will. Okay, so if I please and worship this idol, then I will have favor with God, and God will do what I want him to do. Does that sound familiar to any of us? That's kind of scary, isn't it? God is saying, no more of that, no other gods, no idols, just you and me. If you want to be in relationship with me, I demand just us. So through these two commandments, God names for us, if his people want to be in relationship with him, here are the two components. The first component is priority. Priority meaning you will make me, your God, the first and primary relationship in your life. I will come before all else, even H&M. I will come before everything. There will be nothing that stands between us. The second component is fidelity. Fidelity meaning you will be faithful to me as your only spiritual relationship. Any devotion to any other god or any other idol, I'm going to consider that spiritual infidelity or spiritual adultery. I demand to be your only god. So priority and fidelity, first two components, I'll be your first and I'll be your only god. You shall not worship any one or anything before, opposed to, or alongside me, because that was common. It was like spiritual insurance, like, okay, I'm going to please all these seven gods, because if the first six fail, then the seventh one will deliver for me. God says no more of that. There's only me. If you want to be in relationship with me, it means I want your full devotion. Now, that just makes me think, as a newlywed, is there any other relationship in our lives and in our world that's kind of key and common that begins with two partners mutually agreeing and making commitments that they will make the other one their first and only for the rest of their life? Can you think of any relationships like that? Marriage, yes. One guy is married. That is great. The marriage vows that we use in our modern Christian tradition, or even in Western tradition, didn't just come out of thin air. They didn't come from like a Nicholas Sparks novel, right? They didn't come from Michael Bublé, although that would sound fantastic. But they didn't come from there. They came and they mirror this covenant because the kind of devotion that God is asking for from his people is the same kind of devotion that any one of us would ask from their spouse. You know what's cool is, even the way these commandments and this covenant were presented from God to the people actually mirrors the way a marriage covenant was built in that time too. So when two parties would enter a marriage covenant in this culture, the covenant would be carved into two stone tablets. And some of you have maybe seen like artwork where Moses is holding the two stone tablets, one in each arm. Well, when God establishes this covenant with his people, he carves the covenant into two stone tablets. I don't know if you guys... Usually when I picture this, you know, it's usually wrong. It's usually not the way that historically it was actually done. I usually picture like Mel Brooks, you know, the history of the world where he's got, you know, the five commandments on one tablet and then five on another. And then he's got five on another and he drops one. You know that part? Okay, never mind. He says, well, I've got these 15. Oh, 10. 10 commandments. Yeah, unfortunately, that's not actually the way that it went down in history. But here's what happened. With the two stone tablets, the whole covenant would be written onto both of the tablets in full. So each tablet would have the whole agreement on it, and one would go to the bride, and one would go to the groom, so that each one had a full copy. We didn't have copy machines, we just had rocks, right? So we had to carve it into that, one to the other, so they both had a full copy. So when God presents his covenant to his people in this way, he did it in a way that they could not mistake. This is how marriage covenants were established, and this is how he's establishing his covenant. It is exactly the same way. So it's right here in the very beginning of this covenant, God names the thing that invokes his jealousy, which is what we're here to talk about this morning. What invokes his jealousy? It's the breach of the agreement and the promise for priority and fidelity. It's when his people do not make him their first and their only. God's jealousy is invoked by idolatry. God's jealousy is invoked by idolatry. Idolatry, plain and simple, is when we break from that agreement. It's when we don't make God our first and only. We might be doing all of the things, but if it's not the first, if he's not the first and only of our heart and our devotion, that's idolatry. It's when we love anyone or anything more than or instead of God. Does that make sense? Idolatry is when we love anything or anyone more than or instead of God. So if God's jealousy then is invoked by idolatry, okay, so we know that, we can agree to that here in this contract. Actually, you know what's interesting? If you read through the entire Old Testament, probably not a lot of you have done that, it's kind of boring sometimes, but if you read through the entire Old Testament, every single time that God's jealousy is referenced, do you know what invoked it? His people committing idolatry. This is a serious thing. So when I got to this point in studying, I had the same question just running through my head. I don't know if you guys have this too. But it's, what the heck was God so jealous of? God's God. What is he jealous of? People making little wooden carvings? I mean, why is that a big deal? What is he so jealous of? Was he jealous of the other gods who were getting all the attention that he really wanted because he had like an inflated ego or something? Like God is going down later to the god coffee shop and the other gods are bragging about like, hey, you know Robert, I know you've been trying to get him. I got him. Sorry, God. So, yeah, sorry about that. No, that doesn't happen. There's no God coffee shop. In fact, there are no other gods. Was he jealous of the fancy ritual rituals and festivals and traditions that other gods and idols were getting because he kind of wished those people would do those things for him. Like, oh, hey, that's a really fun dance. I wish somebody would do that for me. Gosh, I'm jealous of that. Was he jealous of the gifts and the sacrifices that other gods and idols were getting? Like in the same way that Santa Claus would be really jealous if we gave our milk and cookies instead to the Hanukkah armadillo? Was he jealous in that way? Is that what he was so jealous of? And we're living, and now if we're asking those types of questions, I think we're getting close, but we're living right here in the difference between our human, normal, cultural understanding of jealousy and God's righteous, divine definition of jealousy. Here's what the difference is, I think. God is not jealous of. God is jealous for. God is not jealous of. God is jealous for. That's small. It's only three letters. That one word, that small change, changes everything, I think, about our understanding of God's jealousy. God is not jealous of the other gods because he knows they don't even exist. God is jealous for the relationship he could be having with his people if they would stop occupying themselves with these false and imaginary gods. God is not jealous of the rituals and sacrifices and gifts being presented to other gods. God is jealous for the devotion of the hearts that are presenting those things. God is not jealous of in the sense that he wishes he had something that he didn't already have. God is jealous for in the sense that he just so desperately wants to reclaim the things that are already rightfully his. That's God being jealous for. God knows his people can't be protected and loved and built up by any of the other imaginary gods and idols that they've created. He's so jealous for the people that he created to be in relationship with him. And he knows the only way his relationship can be restored is if they return to a fully devoted relationship with him built on priority and fidelity. It's the same type of devotion anyone would ask for in a spouse. And believe me, I know. So here, if you're still a little gray on this difference between jealous of, jealous for, human jealousy, godly jealousy, let me tell you. So like I said, I got married 3 weeks ago. This is the part where you cheer. We like marriage, right? Yeah, I got married 3 weeks ago. I met my wife, Celeste is her name. I met her right here at Christ the King Church. I had just come on staff. She was a volunteer with another ministry. And with the support of our community, we began dating. And then we became engaged, which was really scary but cool. And then we found a CTK pastor and his wife who we really love and respect and trust. And under their care, we went through pre-marriage counseling or pre-marriage mentoring. I want to tell you, we passed. We got a B-. Celeste got an A+. I got a C. You know, it's just, it averages out. But luckily, we passed. We had a wedding 3 weeks ago. And so, as now I've been living for the last 3 weeks as an old, seasoned veteran of marriage, I think you all should agree with me that I am now an all-knowing, supreme marriage expert. And when I talk to you about marriage, you should all lean in really close. Because what I have to share is going to be really profound. Actually, here's what I'm working with. I met a guy earlier this week. He's in his 70s, and I was just talking to him about, oh, yeah, I'm newly married. He says, you know, my first wife, when I was in my 20s, after 21 days, she left me flat. Never saw her again, never heard from her. She was just gone. And I'm like, oh, well, hey. I guess that means Celeste and I have made it. All right. Fortunately for that guy, his second wife has stuck with him 43 plus years, so he's doing okay. But man, if 21 days is the cutoff, hey, celebrate. But here's the distinction, right? If my wife Celeste, she works at Western Washington University, if she's at work or she's on the bus or she's going to the store, doing whatever, right, and she's out and some guy starts paying attention to her and he starts talking with her and maybe he even flirts with her a little bit and maybe he asks for her phone number, he wants a little bit of her attention. Right, and he maybe even presents an opportunity for her to break the marriage covenant that I have with her, which is that I will be her first and only. And she brushes him off, which is good, but she doesn't quite brush him off quite as fast as I want her to, because I'm a little insecure, and I think that, and my human jealousy gets stirred up, and then I get mad, and then I start yelling at her, and I start telling her, gosh, how dare you? How could you do that to me? You're not supposed to be paying attention to the other guy. I'm the only guy. I'm your husband. That's me invoking this sort of stupid, normal, human, cultural, potentially sinful jealousy, okay? That's an example, and probably some of us have felt that, right? Especially those of us who have been in relationships. So here's the flip side, right? So say it's me. Say I'm here at work, or I'm out at the store, or I spend a lot of time in coffee shops, or as you can imagine, I spend a lot of time eating cheeseburgers, and say I'm out doing those things, and a woman approaches me and starts paying attention to me, and maybe she flirts with, it's never happened, but say she flirts with me a little bit, and then maybe she asks for my phone number, and then she maybe gives me an opportunity to break the marriage covenant that I have with Celeste, and then I do that, and I let the relationship become something that it shouldn't be, and I start giving this woman what belongs to Celeste because I've committed to Celeste that she'll be my first and only. It doesn't really even matter how far, how many lines I cross. That covenant is broken. And then Celeste finds out. Celeste then has the two choices when it comes to jealousy. Celeste can choose the human, normal, sinful jealousy, and she can get mad at me, and she can hate me, and she can resent this other woman, and she can say, you've broken our covenant, I don't want anything to do with you again. Or she can drop everything. She can come and find me in my sin. She can put up barriers around me for anything that would distract me from the covenant that I made with her. She can fight with every last drop of blood and sweat and tears to fighting with me to save our marriage relationship, because she knows that the only thing that can be the only way for that to be restored is for us to find the devotion that we once had, the devotion that we would make each other our first and only. And she can choose to work past her normal human sinful jealousy and get to the point where she says, you know what's most important? What's most important is this marriage covenant. And so I'm going to fight with you, Fred. That's what the jealousy of a devoted spouse would look like, as opposed to the jealousy of a normal human. Are you starting to see the difference there? When we see God as jealous through our normal human, cultural, potentially sinful lens, it makes sense that we don't like it, right? It makes sense. It kind of paints God as somebody that we know he's not. It paints him as kind of petty, vengeful, acting out of hurt pride and ego, maybe even narcissistic. It was actually a sermon on the jealousy of God that, has anyone ever heard of the Oprah Winfrey? I say the Oprah because, are there any other Oprahs? I mean, the Oprah, I refer to her. So Oprah is somebody who, in her lifetime, has influenced a lot of people and a lot of people away from the Christian church. And when she is asked, why did you leave God? She names a sermon on jealousy as the reason she left God and the Christian church forever. She said she couldn't, because she believed God is love, she couldn't believe that he could also be jealous. Isn't that sad? What Oprah and that pastor probably missed was that God's jealousy is not a substitute or an alternative for his love. It's actually one of God's love's strongest manifestations. God's jealousy for a relationship with his people is not a substitute for his love. It is one of its most potent forms. That's what we miss sometimes. God's jealousy for relationship with his people is what drove him to continue making covenants over and over and over again with his people, because we kept breaking the last one. But he kept making new ones because he's so jealous for his relationship with us. His jealousy, maybe it demands that his people give up all they know, but that's just because God knows that he's the only one who can give us all we need. It's God's jealousy that drove him to go so far as to come to earth, to take on flesh, to live a perfect life, to die a humiliating death, to rise and defeat death so that all of mankind, not just his people at the time, but all of mankind could be restored to relationship and life with God. That God, that jealous God, is present in this room right now, extending his jealousy to each and every one of you. Do you believe that? Isn't that great? Does that sound like a petty, unloving, narcissistic God to you? Not to me. Does that sound like a God, maybe instead, who in his unquantifiable love is so jealous for a relationship with his people that he would do anything to restore that relationship? Pastor Tim Keller is a pastor over in New York. He's way smarter than me, and I don't know all of you personally, but I can promise you he's way smarter than any of you. He's smarter than all of us. Let's just agree with that. He has a definition for God's jealousy that I think is so perfect. Godly, divine jealousy is love fighting against extinction. Human, sinful jealousy is what happens when love has gone extinct. Let's read that again because it's awesome. Godly, divine jealousy is love fighting against extinction. Human sinful jealousy is what happens when love has gone extinct. God's jealousy is not a substitute for his love. It is one of its strongest manifestations, fighting against extinction. So let's try to see his jealousy that way. If God is love, which he is, let's try to see his jealousy as love fighting against extinction. When it gets invoked by our idolatry, it's because his relationship with us has been threatened, and now it has to fight. And I think it fights when it's invoked and manifests itself in two major ways. And here's what they are. The first one is God's jealousy protects us. God's jealousy protects us. The second one is that God's jealousy pursues us. Because God is a jealous God, whose first and foremost desire for us is that we would be devoted to him like a spouse, he protects us by fighting off all that would draw us away from him in that relationship. He doesn't undermine or supersede the free will that he's given you, but he puts up protective layers around you so that you can have that relationship with him. And the beautiful thing is that through his protection as well, he gives you the strength and the calling to do the same. He doesn't just do this on his own. He asks for your participation, and he makes you able to be able to participate. That's a beautiful thing. We believe that God, like I said, doesn't take full control of the situation, and your participation is totally needed, but his protection sets you up to be able to do that. And I think if each of us, no matter where we are in our exploration and our walk with God, if we were really to sit and reflect for a good amount of time, we could see the clear paths that God has carved out in our lives in order to bring us to him. I think we would see how God has strategically built relationships into our life too that make it safe for us to explore what it would look like in our lives to be fully devoted to him in the way that he asks us to be. I think we could find that. Maybe there's some of you right now that are totally being overwhelmed with, gosh, God's protection is just, I've never thought of it this way, but it's totally just making sense to me now. Because God is a jealous God whose first and foremost desire for us is that we would be devoted to him like a spouse, the second part is he pursues us constantly and he does not stop. Let me tell you, if I was like this guy in his 70s that I met earlier this week and Celeste, after 21 days, were to have taken off, I'm not doing like he did, sitting at home watching TV, eating bugles, hoping that she comes home. No, I'm dropping everything. I'm definitely not on this stage. I'm telling Grant, hey, sorry, bro, I gotta go. I'm calling every number. I'm knocking on every door. I'm going to every city. I'm turning over every edge of the map. I'm turning over every rock until I find my wife. And then even if she fights me, I bring her home, and I fight or I die trying until our marriage relationship is restored. That is jealousy for. That is the pursuit that a jealous God extends to his people, which is you. Even if he gets rejected every single time, our God, our jealous God, keeps showing up and 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 showing up, and he doesn't stop showing up just because he is a jealous God. To finish our time together, I want to share with you a story from the Bible that God uses to show us how he's devoted to his people like a devoted spouse. It's one of my absolute favorite stories in the Bible. I love the Bible for one thing because so many religions have their one book written by their one guy. We've got our one book comprised of about 60 books written by about 25 to 30 guys, and they all reveal the same God. That's no happy accident. That's an amazing thing. So this story from the Old Testament, from after Moses and before Jesus, shows us the devotion of God to us like a spouse. That is setting up the story of Christ being devoted to us like a spouse. After Moses and before Jesus, God called a prophet named Hosea. So again, if you have your Bibles, you can open to Hosea chapters 1 through 3. And in order to be a living illustration of God's relationship with his people, God gave Hosea, you could call it an undesirable calling. If you know the story of Hosea, you know what I'm talking about. Here's what he says. When the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said, "Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom by forsaking the Lord." So he went and he took Gomer. Whoredom is the word that they choose. Now, when I read that, it kind of feels like I'm using profanity in church. But here's the deal, guys. I can't make the Bible not say what it says. And I'm sure enough not going to tell you that the Bible says something different than what it does say. That's just not a place we're willing to go. So most of the time, we go ahead and we like to insert ourselves as the main good guy in the story, right? Because we're raging narcissists. But that's not what's going on here. God is using this story. He is represented by Hosea. We are represented by Gomer, the wife of Whoredom. God says his people have forsaken him. They have broken the covenant of priority and fidelity. They've committed spiritual adultery, and Gomer will represent them because she also commits adultery. This is serious here. God is not pulling any punches about the state of his people. For Hosea, a man of God, set apart to be a prophet, to marry a prostitute, that's voluntarily, willingly adopting a life of humiliation. This was a dishonorable thing that he was entering into. But he's obedient because this is how God says he wants to teach his people about himself. Hosea and Gomer, they get married, they form a marriage covenant, they probably have their two stone tablets like we talked about, they have three children, and for a while we can assume that everything is going fine. Everything, they're married, they're raising their kids, but at some point, Gomer loses her way. Gomer returns to her life of adultery. She leaves her children, she breaks her marriage covenant with Hosea, she goes and she returns to her life of adultery. Just as God's people have entered covenant with God and then broken it to leave him for other gods and idols, so Gomer has left for other men. This is real life. This is something that happened. And at this point, when Hosea finds out, it's well within his legal rights to divorce Gomer. Well within his rights. In fact, Gomer's crimes are punishable by death in Hebrew law at this time. So it was within Hosea's legal rights to pursue his cheating wife's execution. That's one thing he could do. Hosea could go, he could find another wife who would bring honor to the family and raise his kids with him. But that's the kind of jealousy and pettiness that we would understand as humans, but it's not how God chooses to reveal himself in his jealousy through his devotion to his people in marriage. So here's what happened. The Lord said to me, Hosea, go again. Love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. By the way, I also think raisins are gross, so I'm totally with this. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lethek of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. Go again. Love a woman who is loved by another man, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods. Hosea goes. He drops everything. He knocks on every door. They didn't have phones, so he wasn't calling every number. But he turns over every rock until he finds his wife. And where does he find her? He finds her for sale. He finds her for sale. This is a time when slavery was just done on the streets. It was an open market thing. So we don't know for sure, but Gomer might have been for sale at auction with other sex slaves. Gomer might have been for sale at auction. Hosea might have had to buy her from the man, that she was living in adultery with. Gomer might have taken on some debt she couldn't repay, and so Hosea had to cover that debt in order to get Gomer back. We don't know for sure, but regardless of those three options, whatever happened, Gomer, through her adultery, had cheapened herself to the price of about half of what a slave was worth in those days. That's how much she was worth to the world at that time when Hosea bought her back. But regardless, he brings her home. And what does he say to her? You will be mine for many days. And then he does something awesome. He voluntarily recommits his devotion to her. He says, so will I also be with you. This is the devotion of a jealous for spouse. This is the devotion of a God who says, you can keep breaking those covenants. I'm going to keep protecting and pursuing you. I'm not jealous of the other gods that you're worshiping. I'm jealous for you. This is what we mean when we say God is jealous, guys. God is jealous means that through protecting and pursuing, he will do anything to fight the extinction of the love and devotion of his people. God is jealous means that through Hosea and Gomer, later we see the story of Jesus Christ and his people. Jesus Christ calling himself the bridegroom of his church, which is us. Paul later telling the church at Corinth, I am just trying to make you a pure virgin of a bride for Christ. That's us. God is so jealous, that means he was willing to go anywhere, do anything, pay any price, remember, to bring his people home to him. In Hosea's plea to his people, the word he uses most often, he uses it 22 times. This is later in the book after the story of him and his wife. The word he uses to his people is return. It's return. return. Just as Hosea said to Gomer, return to our relationship. Return to our devotion. I will be yours for many days. So Christ the King Church, I want to ask you, I don't know if you know this, but when you were created, you were God's. And it could be that since that time, you have not shown your full devotion and commitment to him. But God doesn't say, Jesus doesn't say, shame on you. Or gosh, I'm really jealous of the things that you've been following. Jesus says, return. Come home. I will be mine. Or you will be mine for many days, and so will I also be with you. He says, return. This is the devotion of a jealous for God. And that is very, very good news for us. Amen? All right, would you stand and pray with me, Christ the King Church? Lord God, you are a jealous God, and that's a very, very good thing. Lord, thank you. Thank you with our whole hearts. Thank you for being a jealous God. Thank you for fighting for us. Thank you for fighting against the extinction of our love for you and for bringing us home into devoted relationship with you. God, help us. We need your help. Would you help us to make you our first and our only? We want to return to you and your protection and your pursuit. God, we are in awe of the power of your jealousy. We are in awe of how your jealousy is just the strongest manifestation of your love. God, we love you. We love you. Help us as we worship today to see your face and to pray with our whole hearts to you and to bless your name this morning, Lord. Thank you, God, for this time. Amen. Christ the King Church, God bless you. Let's worship together.